Chapter 35. He was cracking up. "Baby, don't you just know it?" That was a line from Huey Piano Smith, now that he thought of it. Went way back. A blast from the past. Huey Piano Smith. Remember how that one went? Ah-ah-ah-ah-day-o, gooba-gooba-gooba-gooba, etc. The wit, wisdom, and social commentary of Huey Piano Smith. Years later, Johnny Rivers had recorded one of Huey's songs, Rockin' Pneumonia and the Boogie-Woogie Flu. Very appropriate to the situation. Good old Johnny Rivers. Good old Huey Piano Smith. "Fuck it," Larry Underwood croaked. He looked terrible. A pale, frail phantom stumbling up a New England highway. "Huey Smith was before my time. Give me the 60s. Sure, the 60s. Those were the days. Mid-60s, late-60s. Flower power. Getting clean for Gene. Andy Warhol with his pink-rimmed glasses and his fucking Brillo boxes. Velvet Underground. The Return of the Creature from Yorba Linda. Norman Spinrad, Norman Mailer, Norman Thomas, Norman Rockwell, and good old Norman Bates of the Bates Motel. Dylan broke his neck. Barry McGuire croaked the eve of destruction. Diana Ross raised the consciousness of every white kid in America. All those wonderful groups, Larry thought dazedly. Give me the 60s and cram 1980 up your ass. Cream, Rascals, Spoonful, Airplane with Grace Slick on vocals, Norman Mailer on lead guitar, and good old Norman Bates on drums. Beatles, Who, Dead. He fell over and hit his head. The world swam away blackly and then came back in bright fragments. He wiped his hand across his temple and it came away with a thin foam of blood on it. Didn't even matter. What fuck, as they used to say back in the bright and glorious mid-60s? What was falling down and hitting your head when you'd spent the last week unable to sleep without waking up from nightmares? And the good nights were the nights when the scream got no further than the middle of his throat. If you screamed out loud and woke up to that, you scared yourself even worse. Dreams of being back in the Lincoln Tunnel. There was somebody behind him, only in the dreams it wasn't Rita. It was the devil. And he was stalking Larry with a lightless grin frozen on his face. The black man wasn't the walking dead. He was worse than the walking dead. Larry ran with the slow, sludgy panic of bad dreams, tripping over unseen corpses, knowing they were staring at him with the glassy eyes of stuffed trophies from the crypts of their cars, which had stalled inside the frozen traffic even though they had some other place to be. He ran, but what good was running when the black devil man, the black magic man, could see in the dark with eyes like snooper scopes? And after a while, the dark man would begin to croon to him, "Come on, Larry, come on, we'll get it together, Larry." He could feel the black man's breath on his shoulder, and that was when he would struggle up from sleep, escaping sleep, and the scream would be stuck in his throat like a hot bone, or actually escaping his lips, loud enough to wake the dead. He was cracking up. "Cracking," he moaned. "Oh, geez, I'm going out of my mind." A part of him that still retained a measure of rationality asserted that that might be true, but what he was suffering from right this minute was heat prostration. After what had happened to Rita, he hadn't been able to ride the motorcycle anymore. He just hadn't been able to. It was like a mental block. He kept seeing himself smeared all over the highway. So finally, he had ditched it. Since then, he'd been walking, how many days? 4, 8, 9? He didn't know. It had been in the 90s since 10 this morning. It was now nearly 4. The sun was right behind him, and he wasn't wearing a hat. Across the road on a hill 200 yards away, glimmering like a beautiful mirage, was a white and rambling New England farmhouse. It had green siding, green trim, and a green shingled roof. Rolling down from it was a green lawn just beginning to look shaggy. At the foot of the lawn, a small rill of brook ran. He could hear it gurgling and chuckling, an entrancing sound. A rock wall meandered along beside it, probably marking the edge of the property, and leaning over the wall at spaced intervals were big, shady elms. He would sit in the shade for a while. That's what he would do. And when he felt a little better about things in general, he would go down to the brook and have a drink and a wash-up. Probably he smelled bad. Who cared, though? Who was there to smell him now that Rita was dead? It was at least 15 degrees cooler in the shade, and Larry let out his breath in a long sigh of pleasure and relief. He put a hand to the back of his neck where the sun had been beating most of the day and pulled it back with a little hiss of pain. Sunburn pain? Get Xylocaine and all that good shit. Get these men out of the hot sun. Burn, baby, burn. Watts, remember Watts? Another blast from the past. The whole human race, just one big heavy blast from the past, a great big golden gasser. Man, you're sick, he said, and leaned his head against the rough trunk of the elm tree and closed his eyes. Sun-dappled shade made moving patterns of red and black on the insides of his lids. The sound of water, chuckling and gurgling, was sweet and soothing. In a minute, he would go down there and get a drink of water and wash up. In just a minute. He dozed. When he woke up, the first thing Larry was aware of was that he felt good. The second thing was that he felt hungry. The third thing was that the sun was wrong. It seemed to have traveled backward across the sky. The fourth thing was that he had to, you should pardon the expression, piss like a racehorse. Standing and listening to the delicious crackle of his tendons as he stretched, he realized that he had not just napped, he had slept all night. He looked down at his watch and saw why the sun was wrong. It was 9:20 in the morning. Hungry. There would be food in the big white house. Canned soup, maybe corned beef. His stomach rumbled. Before going up, he knelt by the stream with his clothes off and splashed water all over himself. He noticed how scrawny he was getting. That was no way to run a railroad. He stood up, dried himself with his shirt, and pulled his trousers back on. A couple of stones poked their wet black backs out of the stream, and he used them to cross. On the far side, he suddenly froze and gazed toward the thick stand of bushes. The fear, which had been dormant in him ever since waking up, suddenly blazed up like an exploding pine knot and then subsided just as quickly. It had been a squirrel or a woodchuck that he had heard, possibly a fox, nothing else. He turned away indifferently and began to walk up the lawn toward the big white house. Halfway there, a thought rose to the surface of his mind like a bubble and popped. It happened casually, with no fanfare, but the implications brought him to a dead halt. The thought was, why haven't you been riding a bicycle? He stood in the middle of the lawn, equidistant from the stream and the house, flabbergasted by the simplicity of it. He had been walking ever since he had ditched the Harley. Walking, wearing himself out, finally collapsing with sunstroke or something so close to it that it made no difference. And he could have been pedaling along, doing no more than a fast run, if that's what he felt like, and he would probably be on the coast now, picking out his summer house and stocking it. He began to laugh, gently at first, a little bit spooked by the sound of it and all the quiet. Laughing when there was no one else around to laugh with was just another sign that you were taking a one-way trip to that fabled land of bananas. But the laughter sounded so real and hearty, so goddamned healthy, and so much like the old Larry Underwood that he just let it come. He stood with his hands on his hips and cocked his head back to the sky and just bellowed with laughter at his own amazing foolishness. Behind him, where the screening bushes by the creek were thickest, greenish-blue eyes watched all of this, and they watched as Larry at last continued up the lawn to the house, still laughing a little and shaking his head. They watched as he climbed the porch and tried the front door and found it open. They watched as he disappeared inside. Then the bushes began to shake and make the rattling sound that Larry had heard and dismissed. The boy forced his way through, naked except for his shorts, brandishing the butcher knife. Another hand appeared and caressed his shoulder. The boy stopped immediately. The woman came out. She was tall and imposing, but seemed not to move the bushes at all. Her hair was a thick, luxuriant black streaked with thick blazes of purest white. Attractive, startling hair. It was twisted into a cable that hung over one shoulder and trailed away only as it reached the swell of her breast. When you looked at this woman, you first noticed how tall she was, and then your eyes would be dragged away to that hair, and you would consider it. You would think how you could almost feel its rough yet oily texture with your eyes. And if you were a man, you would find yourself wondering what she looked like with that hair unpinned, freed, spread over a pillow in a spill of moonlight. You would wonder what she would be like in bed. But she had never taken a man into herself. She was pure. She was waiting. There had been dreams. Once in college there had been the Ouija board. And she wondered again if this man might be the one. Wait, she told the boy. She turned his agonized face up to her calm one. She knew what the trouble was. The house will be all right. Why would he hurt the house, Joe? He turned back and looked at the house longingly, worriedly. When he goes, we'll follow him. He shook his head viciously. Yes, we have to. I have to. And she felt that strongly. He was not the one, perhaps, but if not, he was a link in a chain she had followed for years, a chain that was now nearing its end. Joe, that was not really his name, raised the knife wildly, as if to plunge it into her. She made no move to protect herself or to flee, and he lowered it slowly. He turned to the house and jabbed the knife at it. No, you won't, she said, because he'll lead us to... She fell silent. She was not sure. Already she felt pulled in two ways at once, and she began to wish they had never seen Larry. She tried to caress the boy again, but he jerked away angrily. He looked up at the big white house, and his eyes were burning and jealous. After a while, he slipped back into the bushes, glaring at her reproachfully. She followed him to make sure he would be all right. He lay down and curled up in a fetal position, cradling the knife to his chest. He put his thumb in his mouth and closed his eyes. Nadine went back to where the brook had made a small pool and knelt down. She drank from cupped hands, then settled in to watch the house. Her eyes were calm, her face very nearly that of a Raphael Madonna. Late that afternoon, as Larry biked along a tree-lined section of Route 9, a green reflectorized sign loomed ahead, and he stopped to read it, slightly amazed. The sign said he was entering Maine, vacation land. He could hardly believe it. He must have walked an incredible distance in this semi-days of fear. Either that or he had lost a couple of days somewhere. He was about to start riding again when something, a noise in the woods or perhaps only in his head, made him look sharply back over his shoulder. There was nothing, only Route 9 running back into New Hampshire, deserted. Since the big white house where he had breakfasted on dry cereal and cheese spread from an aerosol can squeezed onto slightly stale Ritz crackers, he had several times had the strong feeling that he was being watched and followed. He was hearing things, perhaps even seeing things out of the corners of his eyes. His powers of observation, just starting to come fully to life in this strange situation, kept triggering at stimuli so small as to be subliminal, nagging his nerve endings with things so small that even in the aggregate they only formed a vague hunch, a feeling of watchedness. This feeling didn't frighten him as the others had. If someone was watching him and just lying back, it was probably because they were scared of him. And if they were scared of poor old skinny Larry Underwood, who was now too chicken to even go putting along on a motorcycle at 25 miles an hour, they were probably nothing to worry about. Now, standing astride the bike he had taken from a sporting goods shop, he called out clearly, "If someone's there, why don't you come on out? I won't hurt you." There was no answer. He stood on the road by the sign marking the border, watching and waiting. A bird twittered and then swooped across the sky. Nothing else moved. After a while, he pushed on. By 6 that evening, he had reached the little town of North Berwick at the junction of Routes 9 and 4. He decided to camp there and push onto the seacoast in the morning. He ate a light supper in the play yard of the local grammar school and drank a 6-pack of beer. Then, half drunk and feeling pleasant, he rode up Route 9 a quarter of a mile and found a house with a screened-in porch. He parked the bike on the lawn, took his sleeping bag, and forced the porch door with a screwdriver. He looked around once more, hoping to see him or her or them. They were still keeping up with him, he felt it. But the street was quiet and empty. He went inside with a shrug. It was still early, and he expected to lie restless for a while at least, but apparently he still had some sleep to catch up on. 15 minutes after lying down, he was out, breathing slowly and evenly, his rifle close by his right hand. If I dreamed, Larry thought, they must have been good dreams. He couldn't remember any of them. He felt like his old self, and he thought today would be a good day. He would see the ocean today. He rolled up his sleeping bag, tied it to the bike carrier, went back to get his pack, and stopped. A cement path led up to the porch steps, and on both sides the grass was long and violently green. To the right, close by the porch itself, the dewy grass was beaten down. When the dew evaporated, the grass would spring back up, but now it held the shape of footprints. He was a city boy, no kind of woodsman, but you would have to be blind, he thought, not to see by the tracks that there had been two of them, a big one and a small one. Sometime during the night, they had come up to the screen and looked in at him. It gave him a chill. It was the stealth he didn't like. If they didn't show themselves pretty quick, he thought, I'm going to try and flush them out. Just the thought that he could do that brought most of his self-confidence back. He slipped into his pack and got going. By noon, he had reached US 1 in Wells. He flipped a coin, and it came up tails. He turned south on 1, leaving the coin to gleam indifferently up from the dust. Joe found it 20 minutes later and stared at it as if it were a hypnotist's crystal. He put it in his mouth, and Nadine made him spit it out. 2 miles down the road, Larry saw it for the first time, the huge blue animal, lazy and slow this day. It was completely different from the Pacific or the Atlantic that lay off Long Island. This water was a darker blue, nearly cobalt, and it came up to the land in one rushing swell after another and bit at the rocks. Spume as thick as egg white jumped into the air and then splattered back. The waves made a constant growling boom against the shore. Larry parked his bike and walked toward the ocean, feeling a deep excitement that he couldn't explain. He was here. He had made it to the place where the sea took over. This was the end of East. This was land's end. He crossed a marshy field, his shoes squishing through water, standing around hummocks and clumps of reeds. There was a rich and fecund tidal smell. As he drew closer to the headland, the thin skin of earth was peeling away and the naked bone of granite poked through. Granite, Maine's final truth. Gulls rose, clean white against the blue sky, crying and wailing. He had never seen so many birds in one place before. It occurred to him that, despite their white beauty, gulls were carrion eaters. The thought that followed was nearly unspeakable, but it had formed fully in his mind before he could push it away. The pickings must be real good just lately. He began to walk again, and a moment later he stood upon the naked headland. The sea wind struck him full force, lifting his heavy growth of hair back from his forehead. He lifted his face into it, into the harsh, clean, salt smell of the blue animal. The combers, glassy blue-green, moved slowly in, their slopes becoming more pronounced as the bottom shallowed up beneath them, their peaks gaining first a curl of foam, then a curdly topping. Then they crashed suicidally against the rocks, as they had since the beginning of time, destroying themselves, destroying an infinitesimal bit of the land at the same time. There was a ramming, coughing boom as water was forced deep into some half-submerged channel of rock that had been carved out over the millennia. He sat down with his feet dangling over the edge, feeling a little overcome. He sat there for half an hour or better. The sea breeze honed his appetite, and he rummaged in his pack for lunch. He ate heartily. Thrown spray had turned the legs of his blue jeans black. He felt cleaned out, fresh. He walked back across the marsh, still so full of his own thoughts that he first supposed the rising scream to be the gulls again. He had even started to look up at the sky before he realized with a nasty jolt of fear that it was a human scream, a war cry. A young boy was running across the road toward him, muscular legs pumping. In one hand, he held a long butcher knife. He was naked except for underpants, and his legs were crisscrossed with bramble welts. Behind him, just coming out of the brush and nettles on the far side of the highway, was a woman. She looked pale, and there were circles of weariness under her eyes. "Joe," she called, and then began to run as if it hurt her to do so. Joe came on, never heeding, his bare feet splashing up thin sheets of marsh water. His entire face was drawn back in a tight and murderous grin. The butcher knife was high over his head, catching the sun. "He's coming to kill me," Larry thought, entirely poleaxed by the idea. "This boy, what did I ever do to him?" Joe! The woman screamed, this time in a high, weary, despairing voice. Joe ran on, closing the distance. Larry had time to realize he had left his rifle with his bike, and then the screaming boy was upon him. As the boy brought the butcher knife down in a long, sweeping arc, Larry's paralysis broke. He stepped aside and, not even thinking, brought his right foot up and sent the wet, yellow work boot it was wearing into the boy's midriff. And what he felt was pity. There was nothing to the kid. He went over like a candle pin. He looked fierce, but he was no heavyweight. Joe, Nadine called. She tripped over a hummock and fell to her knees, splashing her white blouse with brown mud.
Don't hurt him. Please don't hurt him.
Joe had fallen flat on his back. Larry took a step forward and tromped on his right wrist, pinning the hand holding the knife to the muddy ground. Let go of it, kid. The boy hissed and then made a grunting, gobbling sound like a turkey. His upper lip drew back from his teeth. His Chinese eyes glared into Larry's. Keeping his foot on the boy's wrist was like standing on a wounded but still vicious snake. He could feel the boy trying to yank his hand free, and never mind if it was at the expense of skin, flesh, or even a broken bone. He jerked into a half-sitting position and tried to bite Larry's leg through the heavy, wet denim of his jeans. Larry stepped down even harder on the thin wrist, and Joe uttered a cry, not of pain, but defiance. Let it go, kid! Joe continued to struggle. The stalemate would have continued until Joe got the knife free or until Larry broke his wrist if Nadine had not finally arrived, muddy, breathless, and staggering with weariness. Without looking at Larry, she dropped to her knees. Let it go, she said quietly, but with great firmness. Her face was sweaty but calm. She held it only inches above Joe's contorted, twisting features. He snapped at her like a dog and continued to struggle. Grimly, Larry strove to keep his balance. If the boy got free now, he would probably strike at the woman first. Let it go, Nadine said. The boy growled. Spit leaked between his clenched teeth. We'll leave you, Joe. Larry felt a further tensing of the arm under his foot, then a loosening. The fierce anger was leaking out of the boy's face. We'll leave you behind, she said. I'll leave you and go with him, unless you're good. A further relaxation. But the boy was looking at her grievingly, accusingly, reproachfully. Then he shifted his gaze slightly to look up at Larry, and he could read the hot jealousy in those blue-gray eyes. Even with the sweat running off him in buckets, that stare made Larry feel cold. She continued to speak calmly. No one would hurt him. No one would leave him. If he let go of the knife, everyone would be friends. Gradually, Larry became aware that the hand under his shoe had relaxed and let go of the knife. The boy lay dormant, staring up at the sky. He had opted out. Larry took his foot off Joe's wrist, bent quickly, and picked up the knife. He turned and scaled it up and out toward the headland. The blade whirled and whirled, throwing off spears of sunlight. Joe's strange eyes followed its course, and he gave one long, hooting wail of pain. The knife bounced on the rocks with a thin clatter and skittered over the edge. Larry turned back and regarded them. The woman was looking at Joe's right forearm where the waffled shape of Larry's boot was deeply embedded and turning an angry, exclamatory red. Her dark eyes looked up from that to Larry's face. They were full of sorrow. Larry felt the old defensive and self-serving words rise. I had to do it. It wasn't my fault. Listen, lady, he wanted to kill me. Because he thought he could read the judgment in those sorrowing eyes. You ain't no nice guy. But in the end, he said nothing. The situation was what the situation was, and his actions had been forced by the kids. Looking at the boy, who had now curled himself up desolately over his own knees and put a thumb in his mouth, he doubted if the boy himself had initiated the situation. And it could have ended in a worse way, with one of them cut or even killed. So he said nothing, and he met the woman's soft gaze and thought, I think I've changed, somehow. I don't know how much. She said, I'm Nadine Cross. This is Joe. I'm happy to meet you. Larry Underwood. They shook hands, both smiling faintly at the absurdity. Let's walk back to the road, Nadine said. They started off side by side, and after a few steps, Larry looked back over his shoulder at Joe, who was still sitting over his knees and sucking his thumb, apparently unaware they were gone. "He'll come. Are you sure?" "Quite sure." As they came to the highway's gravel shoulder, she stumbled, and Larry took her arm. She looked at him gratefully. "Can we sit down?" she asked. "Sure." So they sat down on the pavement, facing each other. After a little bit, Joe got up and plodded toward them, looking down at his bare feet. He sat a little way apart from them. Larry looked at him warily, then back at Nadine Cross. "You were the two following me."
"You knew?"
"Yes, I thought you did."
"How long?"
2 days now," Nadine said. "We were staying in the big house at Epsom." Seeing his puzzled expression, she added, "By the creek. You fell asleep by the rock wall." He nodded. "And last night, the two of you came to peek at me while I was sleeping on that porch, maybe to see if I had horns or a long red tail."
"That was Joe," she said quietly. "I came after him when I found he was gone.
How did you know?"
"You left tracks in the dew."
"Oh." She looked at him closely, examining him, and although he wanted to, Larry didn't drop his eyes. "I don't want you to be angry with us. I suppose that sounds ridiculous after Joe just tried to kill you, but Joe isn't responsible."
"Is that his real name?"
"No, just what I call him."
"He's like a savage in a National Geographic TV show."
"Yes, just like that. I found him on the lawn of a house, his house, maybe, the name was Rockway, sick from a bite, a rat bite, maybe. He doesn't talk. He growls and grunts. Until this morning, I've been able to control him, but I'm tired, you see, and..."
She shrugged. Marsh mud was drying on her blouse in what could have been a series of Chinese ideograms.
"I dressed him at first. He took off everything but his underpants. Eventually, I got tired of trying. I was a schoolteacher, not a missionary. The minges and mosquitoes don't seem to bother him."
She paused.
"I want us to come with you. I guess there's no way to be coy about it under the circumstances." Larry wondered what she would think if he told her about the last woman who had wanted to come with him. Not that he ever would. That episode was deeply buried, even if the woman in question was not. He was no more anxious to bring up Rita than a murderer would be to drag his victim's name into parlor conversation. "I don't know where I'm going," he said. "I came up from New York City, the long way around, I guess. The plan was to find a nice house on the coast and just lie up there until October or so. But the longer I go, the more I want other people. The longer I go, the more all of this seems to hit me." He was expressing himself badly and didn't seem to be able to do better without bringing up Rita or his bad dreams about the black man. "I've been scared a lot of the time," he said carefully, "because I'm on my own. Pretty paranoid. It's like I expected Indians to just swoop down and scalp me."
"In other words, you've stopped looking for houses and started looking for people."
"Yes, maybe."
"You found us. That's a start."
"I do believe you found me. And that boy worries me, Nadine. I have to be upfront about that. His knife's gone, but the world is full of knives just lying around waiting to be picked up."
"Yes."
"I don't want to sound brutal." He trailed off, hoping she would say it for him, but she said nothing, only looked at him with those dark eyes.
"Would you consider leaving him?"
There it was, spit out like a lump of rock, and he still didn't sound like much of a nice guy. But was it right, was it fair to either of them, to make a bad situation worse by burdening themselves with a 10-year-old psychopath?
"I couldn't do that," Nadine said calmly. "I understand the danger, and I understand that the danger would be primarily to you. He's jealous. He's afraid that you might become more important to me than he is. He might very well try to get at you again, unless you can make friends with him, or at least convince him you don't mean to..."
She trailed off, leaving that part vague. "But if I left him, that would be the same as murder, and I won't be a party to that."
"You will be if he cuts my throat in the middle of the night."
She bowed her head. Speaking so quietly that only she could hear, he didn't know if Joe, who was watching them, understood what they were talking about or not, Larry said,
He probably would have done it last night if you hadn't come after him. Isn't that the truth? Softly, she replied, those are things that might be. Larry laughed. The ghost of Christmas yet to come? She looked up. I want to come with you, Larry, but I can't leave Joe. You will have to decide. You don't make it easy. It's no easy life anymore. He thought about it. Joe sat on the soft shoulder of the road, watching them with his seawater eyes. Behind them, the real sea moved restlessly against the rocks, booming in its secret channels where it had infiltrated the land. All right, he said. I think you're being dangerously soft-hearted, but all right. Thank you, Nadine said. I will be responsible for his actions. That'll be a great comfort if he kills me. That would be on my heart for the rest of my life, Nadine said. And the sudden certainty that all her words about the sanctity of life would someday, not too distant, rise up to mock her, swept her like a cold wind, and she shuddered. No, she told herself, I'll not kill. Not that. Never that. They camped that night on the soft white sand of the Wells public beach. Larry built a large fire above the strand of kelp that marked the last high tide, and Joe sat on the other side, away from him and Nadine, feeding small sticks into the blaze. Occasionally, he would hold a bigger stick into the flames until it caught like a torch, and then tear away down the sand, holding it aloft like a single flaming birthday candle. They were able to see him until he was beyond the 30-foot glow of the fire, and then only his moving torch, drawn back in the wind manufactured by his wild sprinting. The sea breeze had come up a little, and it was cooler than it had been for days. The breeze danced the flames up toward the black, star-shot sky. Embers cycloned up even higher and flickered out. He thought of fall, still distant, but not so far as it had been on that day in June when he had discovered his mother lying on the floor delirious. He shivered a little. North, far down the beach, Joe's torch bobbed up and down. It made him feel lonely and all the colder, that single light flickering in the large and silent darkness. The surf rolled and boomed. Do you play? He jumped a little at her voice and looked at the guitar case lying beside them on the sand. It had been leaning against a Steinway piano in the music room of the big house they had broken into to get their supper. He had loaded his pack with enough cans to replace what they had eaten this day, and had taken the guitar on impulse, not even looking inside the case to see what it was. Coming from a house like that, it was probably a good one. He hadn't played since that crazy Malibu party, and that had been 6 weeks ago. In another life. Yeah, I do, he said, and discovered that he wanted to play, not for her, but because sometimes it felt good to play. It eased your mind. And when you had a bonfire on the beach, someone was supposed to play the guitar. That was practically graven in stone. Let's see what we got here, he said, and unsnapped the catches. He had expected something good, but what lay inside the case was still a happy surprise. It was a Gibson 12-string, a beautiful instrument, perhaps even custom-made. Larry wasn't enough of a judge of guitars to be sure. He did know that the fretboard inlays were real mother-of-pearl, catching reddish-orange glints from the fire and waxing them into prisms of light. It's beautiful, she said. It sure is. He strummed it, and liked the sound it made, even open and not quite in tune. The sound was fuller and richer than the sound you got from a six-string. A harmonic sound, but tough. That was the good thing about a steel-string guitar. You got a nice, tough sound. And the strings were black diamonds, wrapped and a little hokey, but you got an honest sound, a trifle rough when you changed chords. Zing. He smiled a little, remembering Barry Grieg's contempt for the smooth, flat guitar strings. He had always called them dollar slicks. Good old Barry, who wanted to be Steve Miller when he grew up. What are you smiling about? Nadine asked. Old times, he said, and felt a little sad. He tuned by ear, getting it just right, still thinking about Barry and Johnny McCall and Wayne Stuckey. As he was finishing, she tapped him lightly on the shoulder, and he looked up. Joe was standing by the fire, a burned-out stick held forgotten in one hand. Those strange eyes were staring at him with frank fascination, and his mouth was open. Very quietly, so quietly that it might have been a thought in his own head, Nadine said, "Music hath charms." Larry began to pick out a rough melody on the guitar, an old blues he had picked up off an Elektra folk album as a teenager. Something originally done by Corner, Ray, and Glover, he thought. When he thought he had the melody right, he let it walk off down the beach and then sang. His singing was always going to be better than his playing. "Well, you see me coming, baby, from a long ways away. I will turn the night, Mama, right into day, 'cause I'm here. A long ways from my home, but you can hear me coming, baby, by the slapping on my black cat bone." The boy was grinning now, grinning in the amazed way of someone who has discovered a glad secret. Larry scruffed through long unused archives of memory, hunting a second verse, and found one. "I can do some things, Mama, that other men can't do. They can't find the numbers, baby, can't work the conqueror route, but I can, 'cause I'm a long way from my home. And you know you'll hear me coming by the whacking on my black cat bone." The boy's open, delighted grin lit those eyes up, made them into something, Larry realized, that would be apt to make the muscles in any young girl's thighs loosen a little. He reached for an instrumental bridge and fumbled through it, not too badly either. His fingers wrung the right sounds out of the guitar. Hard, flashy, a little bit tawdry, like a display of junk jewelry, probably stolen, sold out of a paper bag on a street corner. He made it swagger a little and then retreated quickly to good old three-finger E before he could fuck it all up. He couldn't remember all of the last verse, something about a railroad track, so he repeated the first verse again and quit. When the silence hit again, Nadine laughed and clapped her hands. Joe threw his stick away and jumped up and down on the sand, making fierce hooting sounds of joy. Larry couldn't believe the change in the kid, and had to caution himself not to make too much of it. To do so would be to risk disappointment. "Music hath charms to soothe the savage beast." He found himself wondering with unwilling distrust if it could be something as simple as that. Joe was gesturing at him, and Nadine said, "He wants you to play something else. Would you? That was wonderful. It makes me feel better, so much better." So he played Jeff Malader's Goin' Downtown and his own Sally's Fresno Blues. He played the Spring Hill Mine Disaster and Arthur Crudup's That's All Right, Mama. He switched to primitive rock and roll, Milk Cow Blues, Jim Dandy, and finally a song he had always liked, Endless Sleep, originally done by Jody Reynolds. "I can't play anymore," he said to Joe, who had stood without moving through this entire recital. "My fingers." He held them out, showing the deep grooves the strings had made in his fingers and the chips in his nails. The boy held out his own hands. Larry paused for a moment, then shrugged inside. He handed the guitar to the boy neck first. "It takes a lot of practice," he said. But what followed was the most amazing thing he had ever heard in his life. The boy struck up Jim Dandy almost flawlessly, hooting at the words rather than singing them, as if his tongue was plastered to the roof of his mouth. At the same time, it was perfectly obvious that he had never played a guitar in his life before. He couldn't bear down hard enough on the strings to make them ring out properly, and his chord changes were slurred and sloppy. The sound that came out was muted and ghostly, as if Joe was playing a guitar stuffed full of cotton, but otherwise it was a perfect carbon copy of the way Larry had played the tune. When he had finished, Joe looked curiously down at his own fingers, as if trying to understand why they could make the substance of the music Larry had played, but not the sharp sounds themselves. Numbly, as if from a distance, Larry heard himself say, "You're not bearing down hard enough, that's all. You have to build up calluses, hard spots on the ends of your fingers, and the muscles in your left hand, too." Joe looked at him closely as he spoke, but Larry didn't know if the boy really understood or not. He turned to Nadine. "Did you know he could do that?" "No. I'm as surprised as you are. It's as if he is a prodigy or something, isn't it?" Larry nodded. The boy ran through "That's All Right, Mama," again getting almost every nuance of the way Larry had played it. But the strings sometimes thudded like wood as Joe's fingers blocked the vibration of the strings rather than making it come true. "Let me show you," Larry said, and held out his hands for the guitar. Joe's eyes immediately slanted down with distrust. Larry thought he was remembering the knife going down into the sea. He backed away, holding the guitar tightly. "All right," Larry said. "All yours. When you want a lesson, come see me." The boy made a hooting sound and ran off along the beach, holding the guitar high over his head like a sacrificial offering. "He's gonna smash it to hell," Larry said. "No," Nadine answered. "I don't think he is." Larry woke up sometime in the night and propped himself up on one elbow. Nadine was only a vaguely female shape wrapped up in three blankets a quarter of the way around the dead fire. Directly across from Larry was Joe. He was also under several blankets, but his head stuck out. His thumb was corked securely in his mouth. His legs were drawn up, and between them was the body of the Gibson 12-string. His free hand was wrapped loosely around the guitar's neck. Larry stared at him, fascinated. He had taken the boy's knife and thrown it away. The boy had adopted the guitar. Fine, let him have it. You couldn't stab anybody to death with a guitar, although Larry supposed it would make a pretty fair blunt instrument. He dropped off to sleep again. When he woke up the next morning, Joe was sitting on a rock with the guitar in his lap and his bare feet in the run of the surf, playing Sally's Fresno Blues. He had gotten better. Nadine woke up 20 minutes later and smiled at him radiantly. It occurred to Larry that she was a lovely woman, and a snatch of song occurred to him, something by Chuck Berry. "Nadine, honey, is that you?" He built up the fire, and the three of them sat close to it, working the night chill out of their bones. Nadine made oatmeal with powdered milk, and they drank strong tea brewed in a can, hobo fashion. Joe ate with the Gibson across his lap. And twice Larry found himself smiling at the boy and thinking you couldn't not like someone who liked the guitar. They cycled south on one. Joe rode his bike straight down the white line, sometimes ranging as far as a mile ahead. Once they caught up to him, placidly walking his bike along the verge of the road and eating blackberries in an amusing way. He would toss each berry into the air, unerringly catching them in his mouth as they came down. An hour after that, they found him seated on a historic Revolutionary War marker and playing Jim Dandy on the guitar. Just before 11 o'clock, they came to a bizarre roadblock at the town line of a place called Agunquit. Three bright orange town dump trucks were driven across the road, blocking it from shoulder to shoulder. Sprawled in the back of one of the dump bins was the crow-picked body of what had once been a man. The last 10 days of solid heat had done their work. Where the body was not clothed, a fever of maggots boiled. Nadine turned away. "Where's Joe?" she asked. "I don't know. Somewhere up ahead." "I wish he hadn't seen that. Do you think he did?" "Probably," Larry said. He knew how she felt. It would have been good to spare the boy this. "Why did they block the road?" she asked him. "Why would they do that?" "They must have tried to quarantine their town. I imagine we'll find another roadblock on the other end." "Are there other bodies?" Larry put his bike on its stand and looked. "Three," he said. "All right, I'm not going to look at them." He nodded. They wheeled their bikes past the trucks and then rode on. The highway had turned close to the sea again, and it was cooler. Summer cottages were jammed together in long and sordid rows. People took their vacations in those tenements? Larry wondered. Why not just go to Harlem and let your kids play under the hydrant spray? "Not very pretty, are they?" Nadine asked. On either side of them, the essence of honky-tonk beach resort had now enclosed them. Gas stations, fried clam stands, dairy treats, motels painted in feverish pastel colors, mini-golf. Larry was drawn two painful ways by these things. Part of him clamored at their sad and blatant ugliness, and at the ugliness of the mines that had turned this section of a magnificent, savage coastline into one long highway amusement park for families and station wagons. But there was a more subtle, deeper part of him that whispered of the people who had filled these places and this road during other summers. Ladies in sun hats and shorts too tight for their large behinds, college boys in red and black striped rugby shirts, girls in beach shifts and thong sandals, small screaming children with ice cream spread over their faces. They were American people, and there was a kind of dirty, compelling romance about them whenever they were in groups. Never mind if the group was in an Aspen ski lodge or performing their prosaic, arcane rites of summer along Route 1 in Maine. And now all those Americans were gone. A thunderstorm had ripped a branch from a tree, and it had knocked the gigantic plastic dairy treat sign into the ice cream stand's parking lot, where it lay on its side like a pallid dunce cap. The grass was starting to get long on the mini golf course. This long stretch of highway between Portland and Portsmouth had once been a 70-mile amusement park, and now it was only a haunted funhouse where all the clockwork had run down. "Not so pretty, no," he said. "It will be again," she said calmly, and he looked at her clean and shining face. Her forehead, from which her amazing white-streaked hair was drawn back, glowed like a lamp. "I am not a religious person, but if I was, I would call what has happened a judgment of God. In 200 years it will all be new again." "Those trucks won't be gone in 200 years. "No, but the road will be. The trucks will be standing in the middle of a field or a forest, and there will be a lousewort and lady slipper growing where their tires used to be. They won't really be trucks anymore. They will be artifacts." "I think you're wrong."
"How can I be wrong?"
"Because we're looking for other people," Larry said. "Now, why do you think we're doing that?" She gazed at him, troubled.
"I don't know what you mean," she said.
"What I mean is we want to hurry up and get together so we can start killing each other in the bars on Saturday night again," he said, and then laughed. It was a cold and unhappy sound with no humor in it at all. It hung on the deserted air for a long time. Joe wasn't so far ahead after all. They came upon him sitting on the back bumper of a blue Ford parked in the driveway. He was looking at a girly magazine he had found somewhere, and Larry observed uncomfortably that the boy had an erection. He shot a glance at Nadine, but she was looking elsewhere, perhaps on purpose. When they reached the driveway, Larry asked, "Coming?" Joe put the magazine aside and, instead of standing up, made a guttural interrogative sound and pointed up in the air. Larry glanced up wildly, for a moment thinking the boy had seen an airplane. Then Nadine cried, "Not the sky, the barn!" Her voice was close and tight with excitement. "On the barn! Thank God for you, Joe. We never would have seen it." She went to Joe, put her arms around him, and hugged him. Larry turned to the barn, where white letters stood out clearly on the faded shingle roof. "Have gone to Stovington, Vermont, Plague Center." Below that were a series of road directions. And at the bottom, "Leaving Ogunquit, July 2nd, 1980, Harold Emery Lauder, Francis Goldsmith." "Jesus Christ, his ass must have been out to the wind when he put that last line on," Larry said.
"The Plague Center," Nadine said, ignoring him. "Why didn't I think of it? I read an article about it in the Sunday Supplement magazine not 3 months ago. They've gone there."
"If they're still alive."
"Still alive? Of course they are. The plague was over by July 2nd. And if they could climb up on that barn roof, they surely weren't feeling sick."
"Either Francis or Harold was feeling pretty frisky," Larry agreed, feeling a half-reluctant excitement building in his own stomach.
"And to think I came right across Vermont." "Stovington is north of Highway 9, quite a ways. They must be there by now, Larry. July 2nd was 2 weeks ago today."
Her eyes were alight.
"Do you think there might be others at that plague center, Larry? There might be, don't you think? Since they know all about quarantines and sterile clothing."
"I don't know," Larry said cautiously.
"Of course it might be," she said impatiently and a trifle wildly.
Larry had not seen her so excited, not even when Joe performed his amazing feat of mimicry on the guitar.
"I'll bet Harold and Francis have found dozens of people, maybe hundreds. We'll go right away. The quickest route...
Wait a minute, Larry said, taking her by the shoulders.
What do you mean, wait? Do you realize?
I realize that sign's waited 2 weeks for us to come by, and this can wait a little longer. In the meantime, let's have some lunch. And old Joe, the guitar-picking fool, is falling asleep on his feet.
She glanced around. Joe was looking at the girly magazine again, but he had started to nod and blink over it in a glassy way. There were circles under his eyes.
You said he just got over an infection, Larry said. He's probably really beat, Nadine.
You're right. I never thought.
All he needs is a good meal and a good nap.
Of course. Joe, I'm sorry. I wasn't thinking.
Joe made a sleepy and mostly disinterested grunt. Larry felt a lump of residual fear rise up in him at what he had to say next, but it ought to be said.
Nadine, can you drive?
Drive? Do you mean do I have a license?
Yes, but a car really isn't that practical with all the stalls in the road, is it? I mean,
I wasn't thinking about a car, he said. And the image of Rita riding pillion behind the mysterious black man, his mind's symbolic representation of death, he supposed, suddenly rose up behind his eyes, the two of them dark and pale, bearing down on him astride a monstrous Harley hog, like weird horsemen of the apocalypse. The thought dried out the moisture in his mouth and made his temples pound, but when he went on, his voice was fairly steady. If there was a break in it, Nadine did not seem to notice. Oddly, it was Joe who looked up at him out of his half-doze, seeming to notice some change.
I was thinking about motorbikes of some kind. We could make better time with less effort and walk them around any messes in the road, like we walked our bikes around those town trucks back there.
Dawning excitement in her eyes.
Yes, we could do that. I've never driven one, but you could show me what to do, couldn't you?
At the words, I've never driven one, Larry's dread intensified.
Yes, he said, but most of what I'd teach you would be to drive slowly until you get the hang. Very slowly. A motorcycle doesn't forgive human error, and I can't take you to a doctor if you get wrecked up on the highway. Then that's what we'll do. We'll... Larry, were you riding a cycle before we came across you? You must have been to make it up here from New York City so quickly.
I ditched it, he said steadily. I got nervous about riding alone.
Well, you won't be alone anymore, Nadine said gaily.
She whirled to Joe.
We're going to Vermont, Joe. We're going to see some other people. Isn't that nice?
Joe yawned.
Nadine said she was too excited to sleep, but she would lie down with Joe until he was under.
Larry rode into a gunquit to look for a motorcycle dealership. There was none, but he thought that he had seen a cycle shop on their way out of Wells. He went back to tell Nadine and found them both asleep in the shade of the blue Ford where Joe had been perusing Wee. He lay down a little way from them, but couldn't sleep. At last he crossed the highway and made his way through the knee-high timothy grass to the barn where the sign was painted. Near the barn's wide double doors, he spotted two empty Pepsi cans and the crust of sandwich. In more normal times, the gulls would have had the remains of sandwich long ago, but times had changed, and the gulls were no doubt used to richer food. He towed the crust. Larry went inside. It was dark, hot, and alive with the softly whirring wings of the barn swallows. The smell of hay was sweet. There were no animals in the stalls. The owner must have let them out to live or die with the superflu rather than face certain starvation. A makeshift ladder was nailed to one of the large supporting beams. Greased with sweat already, not even knowing why he was bothering, Larry climbed up. In the center of the loft, a more conventional flight of stairs went up to the cupola. These stairs were splattered with drips of white paint. He went up to the cupola. It was even hotter up here, and Larry reflected that if Harold and Francis had left their paint up here when the job was done, the barn probably would have burned merrily to the ground a week ago. The windows were dusty and festooned with decaying cobwebs. One of the windows had been forced up, and it gave upon a breathtaking view of the countryside for miles around. He was high enough for the perspective to make the depressing miles of honky-tonk concessions and roadside businesses seem as inconsequential as a little strewing of roadside litter. Beyond the highway was the ocean and the incoming waves, neatly divided by a long pier stretching out from the north side of the harbor. The land was a master artist's oil painting of high summer, all green and gold, wrapped in the still and hazy hush of afternoon. Looking down on the slant of the roof, Larry could read the direction sign upside down. He glanced down at the floor and saw a candy wrapper. He picked it up. A payday nut roll had once been stowed inside it. The sign painter had had guts, maybe. Good taste, no. Anyone with a taste for payday nut rolls had been spending too much time in the hot sun. He went back down the stairs, going slowly and watching his footing. This was no time for a broken leg. At the bottom, something else caught his eye, something carved into one of the support beams, startlingly white and fresh in direct contrast to all the rest of the barn's old dusty darkness. He went over to the beam and peered at the carving, then ran the ball of his thumb over it, part in amusement, part in wonder that another human being had done it on the day he and Rita had been trekking north. He ran his nail along the carved letters again. H.L. loves F.G. in a heart with an arrow. Good for you, Harold, Larry said, and left the barn. The shop in Wells was a Honda dealership, and from the way the showroom bikes were lined up, Larry deduced that two of them were missing. He was more proud of a second find, a crumpled payday wrapper near one of the wastebaskets. It looked as if someone, lovesick Harold Lauder probably, had finished his nut roll while deciding which bikes he and his Amorata would be happiest with. He had balled up his wrapper and shot it at the wastebasket, and missed. Nadine thought his deductions were good, but she was not as fetched by them as Larry was. She was eyeing the remaining bikes in a fever to be off. Joe sat on the showroom's front step, playing the Gibson 12-string and hooting contentedly. Listen, Larry said, it's 5 o'clock now, Nadine. There's absolutely no way we can get going until tomorrow.
But there's 3 hours of daylight left.
That's not enough. I know you're anxious, he said, and put his hands on her shoulders. He could feel the old impatience building up and forced himself to control it. But you've never been on a motorcycle before.
But I can ride a bike, and I know how to use a clutch. I told you that. Please, Larry, if we don't waste time, we can camp in New Hampshire tonight and be halfway there by tomorrow night.
It's not like a bike, goddammit, he burst out. And the guitar came to a jangling stop behind him. He could see Joe looking back at them over his shoulder, his eyes narrowed and instantly distrustful.
Gee, I sure do have a way with people, Larry thought. That made him even angrier.
Nadine said mildly,
You're hurting me.
He looked and saw that his fingers were buried in the soft flesh of her shoulders, and his anger collapsed into dull shame. Sorry, he said. Joe was still looking at him, and Larry recognized that he had just lost half the ground he had gained with the boy. Maybe more. The dean had said something.
What? I said, tell me why it's not like a bike.
His first impulse was to shout at her, If you know so much, go on and try it. See how you like looking at the world with your head on backward. He controlled that, thinking it wasn't only the boy he had lost ground with. He had lost some with himself. They're heavier, he said. One of these 360s goes 350 pounds. You get used to controlling that extra weight very quickly, but it does take some getting used to. In a standard shift car, you operate the gear shift with your hand and the throttle with your foot. On a cycle, it's reversed. The gear shift is foot-operated, the throttle hand-operated, and that takes a lot of getting used to. There are two brakes instead of one. Your right foot brakes the rear wheel, your right hand brakes the front wheel. If you forget and just use the handbrake, you're apt to fly right over the handlebars. And you're going to have to get used to your passenger.
Joe? But I thought he'd ride with you.
I'd be glad to take him, Larry said, but right now I don't think he'd have me. Do you? Nadine looked at Joe for a long, troubled time.
No,
she said, and then sighed. He may not even want to ride on one. It may scare him. If he does, you're going to be responsible for him. And I'm responsible for both of you. I don't want to see you spill.
Did that happen to you, Larry? Were you with someone?
I was, Larry said, and I took a spill. But by then the lady I was with was already dead.
She crashed her motorcycle?
Nadine's face was very still.
No.
What happened, I'd say it was 70% accident and 30% suicide. Whatever she needed from me, friendship, understanding, help, I don't know, she wasn't getting enough. He was upset now, his temples pounding thickly, his throat tight, the tears close. I'd like to do better by you, that's all, you and Joe. Her name was Rita. Larry, why didn't you tell me before? Because it hurts, he said simply. It hurts a lot. That was the truth, but not the whole truth. There were the dreams. He found himself wondering if Nadine had bad dreams. Last night he had awakened briefly, and she had been tossing restlessly and muttering. But she had said nothing today. And did Joe? Did Joe have bad dreams? Well, he didn't know about them, but Fearless Inspector Underwood of Scotland Yard was afraid of the dreams. And if Nadine took a spill on the motorcycle, they might come back. We'll go tomorrow, then, she said. Teach me how tonight. But first it was a matter of getting gassed up. The dealership had a pump, but without electricity it wouldn't run. He discovered that the plate covering the underground tank had recently been pried up, almost surely by the ever-resourceful Harold Lauder. Lovesick or not, payday freak or not, Larry had gained a lot of respect for Harold, almost a liking in advance. He had already developed his own mental picture of Harold, probably in his mid-30s, a farmer, maybe, tall and suntanned, skinny, not too bright in the book sense, maybe, but plenty canny. He grinned. Building up a mental picture of someone you'd never seen was a fool's game, because they were never the way you had imagined. Everybody knows the one about the 300-pound disc jockey with the whipcord thin voice. While Nadine got a cold supper together, Larry prowled around the rear of the dealership. Leaning against a big steel waste can was a crowbar. Curling over the rim of the waste can was a piece of rubber tubing. Found you again, Harold, you old devil. He took the crowbar and the rubber hose back around to the plate covering the tank. Joe, can you come here a minute and help me? The boy looked up from his cheese and crackers and gazed distrustfully at Larry. Go on now, that's all right, Nadine said quietly. Joe came over, dragging his feet a little. Larry slipped the crowbar into the plate's slot and said, Throw your weight on the bar and let's see if we can get it up. For a moment he thought Joe either didn't understand or didn't want to help. Then he grasped the far end of the crowbar and pushed. His arms were thin but belted with scrawny muscle. The plate tilted a little but didn't come up enough for Larry to get his fingers underneath. Lean on it, he said. Those half-savage, up-tilted eyes studied him coolly for a moment, and then Joe balanced on the crowbar, his feet coming off the ground. The plate came up a little more, and Larry squirmed his fingers under it. While he was still struggling for purchase, he happened to think that this was Joe's golden opportunity to do a number on him. If the boy took his weight off the crowbar, the plate would come down and crush or actually sever everything on his hands but his thumbs. Nadine had realized it, too. She had been looking at one of the cycles, but now turned to watch, her body angled into a posture of tension. Her eyes went from Larry, down on one knee, to Joe, who was watching Larry as he leaned his weight on the crowbar. Those seawater eyes were inscrutable, and still Larry couldn't get hold of the plate. Need help? Nadine asked. Her voice was a little unsteady. Sweat ran into his eyes, and he blinked it away. Still, he couldn't get a hold on the bitchy thing. He could smell gasoline. I think we can handle it, Larry said, looking directly at her. A moment later, his fingers slipped into a short groove on the underside of the plate. He threw his shoulders into the work, and the plate tilted up and over, hitting the concrete with a dull clang. He heard Nadine sigh as the crowbar fell to the pavement. He wiped his forehead, which was slimy slick with perspiration, and looked at the boy. That was a good piece of work you did. If you'd let that thing slip, I'd have spent the rest of my life zipping my fly with my teeth. Thanks. He expected no response, except maybe an uninterpretable hoot. But Joe said in a rusty, struggling voice, Weckum. Larry glanced at Nadine, who stared back at him, and then at Joe. Her expression was one of surprised pleasure, and yet she looked as if she had expected this. It was an expression he had seen before, but he could not put his finger on exactly where. "Joe," he said, "did you say welcome?" Joe nodded.
"Welcome. You welcome."
Nadine was holding her arms out, smiling.
"That's good, Joe. Very, very good."
Joe trotted to her and allowed himself to be hugged for a moment or two. Then he went to the bikes and began to look them over again, hooting and chuckling to himself. "Well, he can talk," Larry said. She nodded.
"I knew that, but it's very good to know he can recover. I think he needed two of us. Two halves, he...
Oh, I don't know." She walked away to join the boy, but not before he had seen the flush rising in her cheeks. He began to slip the rubber hose into the hole in the cement, but he saw that she had turned back to watch what he was doing, still blushing. Yes, he thought he knew why well enough. The nasty fear rose in his chest, and he called, "For Christ's sake, Nadine, look out where you're going!" She was concentrating on the Honda's hand controls, not looking where she was going, and she was going to drive directly into a pine tree at a wobbling 5 miles an hour. She looked up, and he heard her say, "Oh," in a startled voice. She swerved the bike, and the Honda did what all Hondas must do when they are swerved sharply at low speed. It fell over. Larry ran to her, his heart in his throat. "Are you okay, Nadine? Are you..." Then she was picking herself up, examining her scraped hands.
"I'm fine. Stupid me, not looking where I was going. Did I hurt the motorcycle?"
"Never mind that. Let me look at your hands." She held them out. He took a plastic bottle of Bactine from his pocket and sprayed them.
"You're shaking," she said.
"Yes, I am. Listen, maybe we'd better just stick to the bicycles. This is dangerous."
"So is breathing. And Joe can ride with you, at least at first."
"He won't..."
"I think he will," Nadine said calmly. "And so do you."
"Well, let's stop for tonight. It's almost too dark to see."
"Once more, I read someplace that if your horse throws you, you should get right back on."
Joe strolled by, paying no attention to them. He was munching blueberries that he had gathered in a motorcycle helmet.
"I guess so," Larry said, defeated. "But will you please watch where you're going and spare me a heart seizure?"
"Yes, sir. Right, sir." She made a comic salute and smiled at him. She had a beautiful, slow smile that eventually lit up her whole face. Larry smiled back unwillingly. There was nothing else to do. This time she putted around the lot twice and then turned out into the road, swinging over too sharply and bringing Larry's heart into his mouth again. But this time the Honda let her get away with it. She went up the hill and out of sight. He saw her switch up to second gear and heard her switch to third and fourth before the bike's engine faded to a meaningless drone melting away to nothing. He stood anxiously in the twilight, waiting for her, slapping at an occasional mosquito. Joe strolled by again, his mouth blue.
"Welcome," he said, and grinned.
Larry managed a strained smile in return. If she didn't come back soon, he would go after her. Visions of finding her lying in a ditch with a broken neck danced blackly in his head. He was just walking over to the other cycle they had gassed up when the droning hum came to his ears again, gradually swelling to the sound of the Honda's engine. He relaxed, a little. Dismally, he realized he would never be able to relax completely while she was on that thing. She came back into sight and pulled up beside him.
"Pretty good, huh?"
She raced the throttle and switched off. "I was getting ready to come after you. I thought you'd had an accident."
"In a manner of speaking, I did. I forgot to use the clutch when I slowed down, and I stalled it."
"Oh. Enough for tonight, Nadine, okay? Please?"
"Yes," she said. "My tailbone hurts."
He lay in his blankets that night, wondering if she might come to him when Joe was asleep. Waiting and wondering, Larry fell asleep himself. He dreamed he was in a field of corn, lost there. But there was music, guitar music. Joe playing the guitar? If he found Joe, he would be all right. Except Joe was just what Nadine called him. The boy's real name was Leo. Leo Rockway. He followed the sound, breaking through one row of corn to the next when he had to, at last coming out in a ragged clearing. There was a small house there, more of a shack, really, the porch held up with rusty old jack lifters. It wasn't Joe playing the guitar. How could it have been? Joe was holding his left hand and Nadine his right. They were with him. An old woman was playing the guitar, playing a jazzy sort of spiritual that had Joe smiling. The old woman was black. She was sitting on the porch, and Larry guessed she was just about the oldest woman he had ever seen in his life. But there was something about her that made him feel good. Good in the way his mother had made him feel good when she would suddenly hug him and say, "Here's the best boy. Here's Alice Underwood's all-time best boy." The old woman stopped playing and looked at them. "Well, say, I got me some company. Step out where I can see you good and plain." So they came closer, the three of them hand in hand, and Joe reached out and set the bold old tire swing into slow pendulum movement as they passed it. The tire's donut-shaped shadow slipped back and forth on the earth. They were in a small clearing, an island in a sea of corn. To the north, a dirt road stretched away to a point. "You like to have a swing on this old box of mine?" she asked Joe. And Joe came forward eagerly and took the old guitar from her bunched hands. He began to play the tune they had followed through the corn, but better and faster than the old woman had. "Bless him, he plays good. Me, I'm too old. Can't make my fingers go that fast nohow. It's the rheumatiz." Nadine asked who she was. They were in a kind of forever place where the sun seemed to stand still 1 hour from darkness, and the shadow of the swing Joe had set in motion would always travel back and forth across the weedy yard. Larry wished he could stay here forever, he and his family. This was a good place. The man with no face could never get him here, or Joe, Leo, or Nadine. "Mother Abigail is what they call me. I'm the oldest woman in eastern Nebraska, I guess, and I still make my own biscuit. You come see me as quick as you can. We got to go on to the free zone and get settled before he gets wind of us. Things are going to happen awful fast, I reckon." A cloud came over the sun. The swing's arc had decreased to nothing. Joe stopped playing with a jangle of strings, and Larry felt the hackles rise on the back of his neck. The old woman seemed not to notice. "Before who gets wind of us?" Nadine asked coldly, and Larry wished he could speak, cry out for her to take the question back before it could leap free and hurt them. "I guess you know, don't you, woman?" "No, I don't know what you're talking about." "You do, but I reckon you don't know what he means for you." "No, you don't know that. We got the Rockies between us and him, praise God, but the mountains won't keep him back long. That's why we got to knit together, out in Colorado. God came to me in a dream and showed me where." "No," Nadine said in that same cold, fearful voice. "We're going to Vermont, and that's all, just a short trip." "Your trip will be longer than ours if and you don't fight off his power," the old woman in Larry's dream replied. She was looking at Nadine with great sadness. "This could be a good man you got here, woman. He wants to make something out of himself. Why don't you cleave to him instead of using him?" "No, we're going to Vermont, to Vermont." The old woman looked at Nadine pityingly. "You'll go straight to hell if you don't watch close, woman. And when you get there, you'll find that hell is cold, cold." The dream broke up then, splitting into cracks of darkness that swallowed him. But something in that darkness was stalking him. It was cold and merciless, and soon he would see its grinning teeth. But before that could happen, he was awake. It was dawn, and the world was swallowed in a thick white ground fog that would burn off when the sun got up a bit more. Someone was next to him, and he saw that it wasn't Nadine who had joined him in the night, but Joe. In the dream, Joe's name had been something else, but now he couldn't remember what. The boy lay next to him, thumb corked in his mouth, shivering in his sleep, as if his own nightmare had gripped him. Larry wondered if Joe's dreams were so different from his own, and he lay on his back, staring up into the white fog, and thinking about that until the others woke up an hour later. The fog had burned off by the time they had finished breakfast and packed their gear. As Nadine had said, Joe showed no qualms about riding behind Larry. In fact, he climbed on Larry's bike without waiting to be asked. "Slow," Larry said for the fourth time. "We're not going to hurry and have an accident." "Fine," Nadine said. "Larry, I'm excited enough just to be going." They stopped for lunch under the tree by the brook where Larry had fallen asleep. He was relieved to find that cycling wasn't nearly as bad as he had thought it might be. They were making fairly decent time, even though it was necessary to putt along the sidewalks at walking speed in the villages they came to along the way. Nadine was being extremely careful going around blind curves, and even on the open road, she didn't urge Larry to go any faster than the steady 35 miles an hour pace he was setting. He thought that, barring bad weather, they would be in Stovington by July 19th. They stopped for supper west of Concord, where Nadine said they could save time on Lauder and Goldsmith's route by taking I-89. "There'll be a lot of stalled traffic," Larry said doubtfully. "We can weave in and out," she said, "and use the breakdown lanes. The worst that can happen is we'll have to backtrack to the nearest exit and go around on a secondary road." They went on for 2 hours after supper, and did indeed come upon a block that was impossible to skirt. A car and trailer combination had struck a gigantic Winnebago camper. The three of them, working together, were able to hoist the bikes over the highway guardrails, trundle them past the wreck, and then hoist them back onto the turnpike. It was exhausting work, and when the block was at last behind them, there was no question of going on. They spread their blankets near the two Hondas and slept. There were no dreams that night. The following afternoon, they came to a colossal smash-up. There was no question of getting around this one. Over a dozen cars had been involved. They were only 2 miles beyond the Enfield exit, and so they didn't have far to backtrack, but all three of them were tired and discouraged. Nadine was particularly snappish because her turnpike idea hadn't worked very well. They stopped in the Enfield Town Park to rest. "What did you do before, Nadine?" Larry asked. "Did you teach?" "Yes, I did." "Little kids?" "First and second grades." That explained a lot about her attachment to Joe and her calm, efficient handling of him. "How did you guess that, Larry?" "I used to date a speech therapist from Oakland," he said. "I know that sounds like the start of some weird, dirty joke, but it's the truth. She worked for the Oakland school system, younger grades, kids with hair lips, cleft palates, deaf kids, the works. She used to say that correcting speech defects in children was just showing them alternate ways of getting certain sounds. Show them, say the word, over and over, until something in the kid's head clicked. And when she talked about the click happening, she looked the way you did when Joe said, 'You're welcome.'" "Did I?" She smiled a little wistfully. "I love the little ones. Some of my kids were bruised, but none of them were spoiled, not irrevocably. The little ones are the only good human beings."
"Do you believe that?"
"Children are good. If you work with them, you get to be a romantic. That's not so bad. Wasn't your speech therapist friend happy with her work?"
"Yeah, she liked it."
"Were you married, Nadine?"
"Married? No, never married."
She looked down at her hands, which were plucking grass nervously. "I'm the original old maid schoolteacher. Younger than I look, but older than I feel. 37. She touched her white-streaked hair. "Premature. My grandmother's hair was completely white by the time she was 40. I think I'm going to last 5 years longer."
"Where did you teach?"
"Pittsfield, a small private school, very exclusive. Ivy-covered walls, all the latest playground equipment. The carpool was two Thunderbirds, one of them a 1957. Three Mercedes, a couple of Lincolns, and a Chrysler Imperial. Damn the energy crisis, full speed ahead."
"You must have been good."
"I was," she said, and smiled. "But it doesn't matter now." He put an arm around her, and she stiffened.
"I wish you wouldn't."
"You don't want me to?"
"No, I don't."
He drew his arm back, baffled. She did want him to, that was the thing. He could feel her wanting coming off her in waves. Her color was very high now, and she was looking desperately down at her hands, which had uprooted a drift of grass. Her eyes were shiny, on the verge of tears. "Nadine, honey, is that you?" She looked up and saw that she was past the verge. She was crying. She was about to speak when Joe strolled up, carrying his guitar case. They looked at him guiltily, as if they had been discovered doing something rather more personal than talking. "Lady," Joe said conversationally. "What?" Larry asked, startled and not tracking very well. "Lady." Joe jerked his thumb back over his shoulder. Larry and Nadine looked at each other. Suddenly there was a new voice, high-pitched and choking with emotion, almost as startling as the voice of God.
"Thank heaven," it cried. "Oh, thank heaven."
They stood up and saw a woman half running up the street toward them. She was smiling and crying at the same time.
"I'm so glad to see you," she said. "Thank heaven."
She swayed and might have fainted if Larry hadn't been there to steady her until her dizziness passed. Larry guessed her age at 25. She was dressed in jeans and a plain white cotton blouse. Her blue eyes stared desperately at Larry, as if trying to convince the brain behind them that this was not a hallucination, that the three people she saw were really here. "I'm Larry Underwood. The lady is Nadine Cross. The boy is Joe. We're all very happy to meet you." The woman continued to stare at him wordlessly for a moment, and then walked slowly away from him and toward Nadine.
"I'm so pleased," she began. "So pleased to meet you."
She stumbled a little.
"Oh, my God, are you really people?"
"Yes," Nadine said. The woman put her arms around Nadine and sobbed. Nadine held her. Joe stood in the street by a stalled pickup truck, his guitar case in one hand, his thumb in his mouth. At last he went to Larry, and Larry held his hand. The two of them watched the woman solemnly. Her name was Lucy Swan, and she was eager to go with them to Stovington and excited at the prospect of meeting Harold and Francis. Larry found a knapsack for her, and Nadine went with her to her house to help her pack. Two changes of clothes, an extra pair of shoes, a raincoat, and pictures of her late husband and daughter. They camped that night in Keechee, now over the state line and into Vermont. Lucy told them her story. It was not much different from the others they would hear. Her husband and daughter had died within a day of each other. She nursed them as best she could, and when they were gone, she waited to catch it and die herself. By July 3rd, she was the only living soul in Enfield, New Hampshire. "Wes and me, we had to get married," Lucy said. "That was the summer of 74, just after I graduated high school. My mom and dad didn't want me to marry him. They wanted me to go away to have the baby and then give her up. But I wouldn't. My mom said it would end in a divorce. My dad said Wes was just a no-account, shiftless man. I said, maybe, we'll see. And we settled down real good, the three of us. It was more Marcy than me that settled Wes down. He thought the sun rose and set on that baby." With a sigh that was more than half a sob, she said, "I sure never thought it would end like this."
"No one did, Lucy," Larry said.
"I guess I could have gotten along. I was, until I started having all those bad dreams."
Larry's head jerked up. "Dreams?" Joe was also looking at her. A moment before, he had been nodding out, but now he was staring at Lucy, his eyes gleaming.
"Bad dreams, nightmares," Lucy said. "They're not always the same. Mostly it's a man chasing me, and I can never see exactly what he looks like because he's all wrapped up in a cloak. And he stays in the shadows in the alleys. I got so I was afraid to go to sleep. But now maybe I'll..."
"Brackman!" Joe cried suddenly.
So fiercely, they all jumped. He leaped to his feet and held his arms out like a miniature Bela Lugosi, his fingers hooked into claws.
"Brackman! Bad dreams! Bad cares! Cares me!"
"Scares me, that's what he's trying to say," Larry thought. "Bad dreams, bad scares. Joe, I couldn't agree more."
"This is crazy," he said aloud, and then stopped. They were all looking at him. Suddenly the darkness seemed very dark indeed, and Lucy looked frightened again. "Lucy, do you ever dream about, well, a place in Nebraska?" "I had a dream one night about an old Negro woman," she said, "but it didn't last very long. She said something like, 'You come see me.' Then I was back in Enfield, and that scary guy was chasing me. Then I woke up." Larry looked at her so long that she colored and dropped her eyes. He looked at Joe. "Joe, do you ever dream about, corn? An old woman? A guitar?" Joe only looked at him from Nadine's encircling arm. "Leave him alone. You'll upset him more," Nadine said, but she was the one who sounded upset. "A house, Joe? A little house with the porch up on Jack's?" He thought he saw a gleam in Joe's eyes. "Stop it, Larry," Nadine said. Inspiration struck. "A swing, Joe. A swing made out of a tire." Joe jerked in Nadine's arms. She tried to hold him, but he broke through. "The swing," Joe said exultantly. "The swing, the swing." He whirled away from them and pointed first at Nadine, then at Larry, then at Lucy. "Her, you, lots." Lucy Swan looked stunned. "The swing," she said. "I remember that, too." She looked at Larry, scared. "Why are we all having the same dream? How can that be? Is someone using a ray on us?" "I don't know," he looked at Nadine. "Have you had them, too?" "I don't dream," she said, but she wouldn't meet his eyes. "Are you sure?" "I told you, I don't dream." Her voice was sharp, nearly hysterical. "Can't you just leave me alone? Do you have to badger me?" She got up and left the fire, almost running. Lucy looked after her uncertainly for a moment, and then stood up. "I'll go after her." "Yeah, you better. Thanks, Lucy." She came back with Nadine shortly. They had both been crying, Larry saw, but they seemed to be on good terms now. "I'm sorry," Nadine said. "It's just that I'm always upset. It comes out in funny ways, I guess, and I'm tired." The subject did not come up again. They sat and listened to Joe run through his repertoire. He was getting very good indeed now, and in with the hootings and grunts, fragments of the lyrics were coming through. At last they slept, Larry on one end, Nadine on the other, Joe and Lucy between. He dreamed first of the black man on the high rooftop, looking east, then of the old woman sitting on her porch. Only in this dream he knew that the man with no face was coming, striding through the corn, knocking his own twisted swath through the corn, his terrible hot grin tattooed to his face, coming toward them, coming closer. Larry woke up in the middle of the night, out of breath, his chest constricted with terror. The others slept like stones. Somehow in that dream he had known that the black man was not coming empty-handed. In his arms, borne like an offering, he had held the decaying body of Rita Blakemore, now stiff and swollen, her flesh ripped by weasels. A mute accusation to be thrown at his feet, a putrid offering that would scream his guilt to the others, to silently proclaim that he wasn't no nice guy, never had been, never would be. The old woman on one side, the black man on the other, he thought, already turning to sleep again. And all the rest of us somewhere between, on the border, choosing up sides. Then he slept again, and his sleep was silent darkness, undisturbed. "Oh, God," Nadine said emptily. Larry looked at her face and saw a disappointment too deep for tears. Her face was pale, her remarkable eyes clouded and dull. It was the evening of July 19th, and the shadows were drawing long. The four of them stood together in a line outside a wrought-iron fence. Below and behind them lay the town of Stovington, not much changed from the way Stu Redmond had seen it on his last day of captivity. Beyond the fence and a lawn that had once been well-kept, but which was now getting shaggy and littered by sticks and leaves that had blown onto it during afternoon thunderstorms, was the plague center itself, three stories high,
Who knew how much more underground? The place was deserted, silent, empty. In the center of the lawn, a large sign had been erected. Route 7 to Rutland, Route 4 to Schuylerville, Route 29 to I-87, I-87 to I-90, I-90 West. Everyone here is dead. We are moving west to Nebraska. Stay on our route. Watch for signs. Harold Emery Lauder, Francis Goldsmith, Stuart Redman, Glenn Bateman, July 8, 1980. "Harold, my man," Larry murmured. "Can't wait to shake your hand and buy you a beer, or a payday." "Larry," Lucy said sharply. Nadine had fainted.